You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of August 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
I'm very pleased to see you again, Jared, with your delegation. We have a lot of things to talk about. How to advance peace, stability, and security in our region, prosperity too. And I think all of them are within our reach.
Israel's Prime Minister keeps a commendably straight face as he welcomes Donald Trump's peace envoy slash son-in-law. My guests Jacob Parakilis and Martin Plaut will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the oratorical shape-shifting of Jared Kushner's father-in-law, the ongoing agonies of South Sudan, and the reason that one American sports broadcaster is grateful that at least his name isn't Stonewall Jackson, Jefferson Davis, Bedford Forrest, Jeb Stuart, James Longstreet, PGT Beauregard. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to the show. My guests today are Jacob Parakilis, Deputy Head of the US and the Americas Program at Chatham House, and Martin Plaut, Fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, University of London. Welcome both. We will start tonight in the Middle East, where we can confidently expect to hear any second that across the region, walls are being torn down, weapons tossed aside, and former enemies embracing centuries of bitter and seemingly intractable religious, ethnic, tribal, and political hatred scaled suddenly back to amiable rivalry over who makes the best hummus. Jared Kushner is in town, bringing to bear all the hard-won expertise that raised him to his present lofty position as senior advisor to his father-in-law. It is surely unimaginable that anything could possibly go wrong. Jacob, first of all, how do we like Jared Kushner's chances of succeeding where everybody else, literally everybody else, has failed for about 3,000 years?
I think you have to assign a nominal percentage chance that it could work in the same way that you have to assign a nominal percentage chance that just any approach could work at this stage, because
this is Cleveland Browns winning the Super Bowl territory.
I think Kushner does not bring a particular expertise in Middle East studies, in Middle East history, in any particular aspect of American diplomacy. Now, it could be, and I say this sort of full in the knowledge that we've seen numerous sacred cows and expectations fall over the last 18 months. It could be that what's needed here is actually just someone to come at it with a completely fresh perspective. The problem is, as envoy of the United States, you don't necessarily come out with a completely fresh perspective. You also bring the decades and decades of sort of expectations of what the U.S. will do, the reverberations and echoes of former American policies. So it will take an enormous level of creativity, inventiveness, and the sort of use of time and energy in order for him to shape U.S. policy. And I'm not sure, given his other responsibilities that he's been assigned by his father-in-law, that Kushner has that.
No, his other responsibilities, which are manifold and onerous. Martin, how seriously do we imagine that Benjamin Netanyahu and Mahmoud Abbas are taking this new intermediary?
Well, probably not terribly, but then they've seen so many come and go in the years. They remain, he goes, the negotiators disappear and are replaced with somebody new, and the possible options are always the same. You can have a two-state solution, you can have a one-state solution, you can have a non-state solution. I mean, they all, you know, everyone knows what's on the table, everybody knows what's available, and they almost got there. I mean, they nearly did it once with Rabin, you remember, and Yasser Arafat. And sadly, of course, it all fell to bits in the end, and Yasser Arafat didn't accept it, and so we didn't get there, which was a great tragedy. But I mean, in a sense, what one has to ask oneself is, why does anybody ever settle for anything, right? So, you can defeat an enemy, right? So one side can win. That does happen in wars. People are defeated. The other thing that could happen
It's happened several times in the context of this particular conflict.
Yeah, well, except nobody's ever really, really won. So, I mean, nobody ever drives the enemy out. So they've always got the same enemy who's there. So they locked together. The second thing that could happen is that you could have a situation in which people actually sort of gradually realise that there's nothing to be gained by going on with this. I mean, I suppose one could say that's the Northern Ireland situation. Mm. Or you could have a major element pulled out of the situation. And I suppose that would be something like the South African situation, where, you know, there was all of a sudden the possibility of reaching a change because the Soviet Union had fell and one side had lost its major backer. So, but nothing has happened so far. Both sides are perfectly happy to go on with the stalemate, as far as I can see. There's been no defeat on anybody, and there hasn't been a major change. So why do we think anything's going to alter?
But on that subject, Jacob, both sides, Israeli and Palestinian, are making the usual and, I guess, expected ceremonial noises about desiring a lasting peace. It's a bleak question, but actually, do they?
That's one with a sort of unknowable answer, I think. I mean, I think, yes, in principle, it would be nice for the Israelis to not have to spend an enormous percentage of their GDP on defense and internal security and wall building and so on and so forth. It would be nice for the Palestinians to not be ringed with walls and sort of faced with unpredictable Israeli military incursions. And, you know, everyone wants peace in principle. But I think the thing that's also true is that wars have and cold pieces and frozen conflicts and all these sort of intermediary categories of conflict that we've created over the last decades have their own logics and they have their own inertia. So, you know, it can be perfectly feasible for a state or a sub-state group to try to freeze things in place and for that to be profitable, for that to make it possible for certain activities, for certain forms of interchange to continue and produce profit generally for a relatively small group of people rather than for society as a whole. So, I mean, there are countervailing forces. I'm sure Netanyahu and Abbas both in principle at some level want there to be a peaceful solution on their own terms, of course, but, you know, they're not the only ones in the driver's seat.
Martin, there's been a line that the assignment of Jared Kushner to this task is an indicator of the seriousness with which Donald Trump takes this enterprise. Although, as Jacob points out, Jared Kushner's been given pretty much every other job in the American administration as well, so it's a little hard to tell. Are we buying that? Which is, I guess, to say I'm asking, are we buying the idea that Donald Trump really cares one way or the other about the Middle East?
Well, I'm sure he'd love to have a huge success on his plate. I mean, this would be, if he succeeded in this one, you know, we'd all take our hats off to him.
I do wonder if it makes a difference with Trump, because even when he fails, he just says it was a massive success.
Well, I mean, he's only achieved one thing as far as I can see so far, which is getting his nominee to the Supreme Court. Apart from that, I can't see anything that he's actually managed to do apart from throw his toys out of the pram, and destroy things. But, we should perhaps be a bit more serious about it. After all, he is leaving behind a couple of people who are serious players. You've got Jason Greenblatt and you've got Dina Powell. Now, Dina Powell is, herself of Egyptian origin and really knows the region extremely well. You know, she's a potential, she knows all the detail that could possibly be put together. So if they wanted a deal, it could be put together. But the problem is, I think that both sides are actually happier with a stalemate because it's secure. Both sides would be destabilized, especially, Netanyahu is facing, corruption charges. Goodness me, he's in court, all the rest of it. Abbas is stuck with Hamas in Gaza. If you started destabilizing the situation by going for a real peace deal, you'd have a lot of problems on your plate.
Jacob, final brief thought on this one. How do we like our chances of Kushner's name being inscribed, if that's what they do on the Nobel Peace Prize trophy?
I think I would not put money on that one. I think, Kushner, as I said earlier, has a lot of different responsibilities that he's been assigned, everything from combating the opioid epidemic to dealing with Mexico and Mexican-American relations to revitalizing the sort of innovative spirit in the federal government. This is something that requires a lot of very sustained, very focused effort. If you look at the effort that went into the Iran deal. And, you know, setting aside the sort of subsequent happenings with the Iran deal, the amount of diplomatic effort, the amount of John Kerry's time and Wendy Sherman's time and all the sort of major players, the heavy hitters in American diplomacy, were almost solely focused on this for 18 months with a huge staff. And, you know, yes, there are a couple of very serious, knowledgeable people who are working on this, but given the sort of absence of a lot of people in the sort of mid to upper levels of the federal government who Trump just hasn't gotten around to nominating yet, Kushner doesn't have the backup that he needs. You know, he's going to spend a few days there and then jet back off to Washington to deal with everything else he's dealing with. And, you know, there aren't the people there necessary to hold the Israelis and Palestinians together and force them to keep negotiating.
Okay, well, let's take a look now at Jared Kushner's father-in-law. Helpfully for the setup of this item, President Donald Trump stomped onto Twitter earlier today to write some reviews of his recent public appearances. His televised Afghanistan speech, he said, was somber. His Phoenix rally, enthusiastic, dynamic, and fun, and an address to the American Legion, respectful and strong. Modestly refraining from awarding himself 5 stars, he further sneered, "Too bad the Democrats have no one who can change tones." Well, let's have a listen to those shifts of gear at which the president excels, if he says so himself. This is Trump on Monday in his televised address to the nation.
The soldier understands what we as a nation too often forget. That a wound inflicted upon a single member of our community is a wound inflicted upon us all. When one part of America hurts, we all hurt. And when one citizen suffers an injustice, we all suffer together. Loyalty to our nation demands loyalty to one another. Love for America requires love for all of its people.
And this is an excerpt of Donald Trump's interminable harangue in Phoenix on Tuesday.
It's time to expose the crooked media deceptions and to challenge the media for their role in fomenting divisions. And yes, by the way, they are trying to take away our history and our heritage. You see that. And I say it, and you know, we're all pros. We're all, like, we have a certain sense. We're smart people. These are truly dishonest people. And not all of them. Not all of them. You have some very good reporters. You have some very fair journalists. But for the most part, honestly, these are really, really dishonest people. And they're bad people. And I really think they don't like our country. I really believe that. And I don't believe they're going to change, and that's why I do this. If they would change, I would never say it. The only people giving a platform to these hate groups is the media itself and the fake news.
Jacob, is either of those the real Donald Trump?
I have almost given up on trying to find the real Donald Trump, because I think Trump is a fundamental... I'm going to be a little bit pretentious about this. I think Trump is a fundamentally protean creature. I think he takes from the crowd that he's in front of a sort of cue as to who he can be. I think he changes himself. I mean, remember, this is a guy whose overwhelming characteristic, whose overwhelming sort of background is as a salesman. And the job of a salesman is to sell you something. What Trump is selling is, what he was originally selling was the idea of the Trump lifestyle brand. He's now selling a particular sort of mono-focused, self-focused version of politics, just Trumpism, which doesn't really have an ideological core. I mean, I think he's the sort of nationalistic stuff, the this is our America being kind of implicitly extremely clear who we are and who they are. I think that stuff has been true for Trump for a long time. So there is, I would say, more of an element of truth in the version of himself that he is at the rallies than he the person who reads the teleprompter. He's clearly a lot happier at the rallies than he is when he's reading from a teleprompter. And the fact that in every case where there's been a sort of sober, somber address followed by... It's that there's the sober, somber address first, and then there's the kind of explosion of of rage at the rally. And that's clearly a release for him that he sort of builds himself up as, you know, he restrains himself to give these teleprompter addresses, and then he lets it out a bit more as the guy at the rally screaming fake news and, you know, our heritage.
Martin, as Jacob points out, and as our clips illustrated, Trump does adjust himself to whatever is in front of him, as a good performer does. But if we agree that the difference between a good performer and a great one is the ability to go in front of an indifferent or hostile audience and win them around, could Trump do that?
It's hard to see it. Really, it is. I can't imagine it happening. I mean, the interesting comment was by Hillary Clinton this week, where she said that when he was on the stage with her, he got so close to her that he was sort of breathing down her neck. And she said, "My skin crawled to have it would." So, I mean, you know, there's somebody who, you know, he could potentially have, you know, reached out to, or, you know, I mean, I know she was an opponent, but, you know, there was somebody else. But that's how people have reacted. The people who hate him genuinely loathe him. It's not they just don't like him, it's they genuinely loathe him. What I don't know, and I mean, perhaps you do, is, you know, is his core base that he's going out to and selling this image of, you know, of fake news and all the rest of it, is it a declining base, or is it a static one?
No, it's declining. I mean, the you've seen a general erosion in his poll numbers over the course of his the short course of his presidency, from somewhere in the mid 40s to somewhere in the lower to mid 30s, depending on which poll you look at, and that's been driven because he came into office already unpopular amongst left-leaning independents, amongst Democrats, in general. What's happened is he's lost some of, not a lot of, but enough to make a statistical difference of the Republican and sort of right-leaning independent base. You know, the people who were willing to vote for him and willing to give him a chance in November and in January and February are increasingly turned away, whether that's by the relative lack of accomplishment of his administration or if there's been some accumulation. I mean, you know, one of the things that frustrates me is I find it a little bit hard to believe that somebody could look at Trump now, having watched him through the election, and say that they're surprised. Everything that he's doing now, it was telegraphed. It was, you know, it was clear that this is how he was going to govern. He wasn't ever going to become some kind of pragmatic, moderate, you know, that version of himself is long gone. So I think that what you're seeing more is people being disabused by the reality of his presidency relative to the outlandish promises he made during the campaign.
Martin, just a final thought on this, and it's one thing, as has been pointed out, when he's campaigning, especially when he wasn't being taken seriously. It's another thing when he's president of the United States. But 7 months or whatever it is we are now into this, have we, and I guess the American people, other world leaders, the markets, etc., have we reached the point, or should we have reached the point, which you just resign yourself to the fact that you cannot take seriously anything he says?
Well, the problem is you have to take seriously what he says. I mean, this is a man who sends missiles, you know, drones and cruise missiles, I think, into Syria, into Yemen, and has sent troops into Afghanistan, which I suppose is, you know, one of the most serious things. Those, the Syrian and the Afghani ones, are the most serious things he's done. He's actually expanded America's war effort, shall we say, against targets that he's trying to accomplish. He's given the head to what I presume some of his military wanted to do. So you have to take this man seriously. He is a man with enormous power at his disposal, and he is already having an effect on all sorts of things, from the sale of, you know, bottled water in the national parks, which used to be banned, is now okay, to you know, scrapping some of the climate change things. I mean, this is a serious man.
I fundamentally agree with that, but I think there's one little sort of aspect of it that, or one significant aspect of it that needs to be kind of expanded on, which is the difference between formal and informal power. He has these formal powers. He can, if he wants, end civilization. He has 1,500 nuclear weapons at his disposal. He has the formal powers of the presidency. What's happened is he's losing the informal powers. Republicans in Congress basically just don't care what he thinks anymore. The Defense Department is running its own wars. He's he has abandoned the real power of the presidency, which is the rhetorical power and the sort of power to convince.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, Jacob Parakilis, and Martin Plaut. Coming up next, South Sudan and the perils of being accidentally named after a Confederate general.
Pack your bags and join us on a global tour through exciting and inspiring cities. From Madrid to Miami, Tokyo to Toronto, we've created travel guides that will help you get the best out of a city, no matter how short your stay. We'll whirl you around some of our favorite architectural spots, top cultural haunts, and then point you in the direction of a well-earned drink from a little-known cocktail bar. We've also scouted the prettiest running routes, the most design-savvy shops, and the best hotels to comfortably rest your head. View our full range of travel guides at monocle.com or visit any good bookstore and plan your next escape today. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Jacob Parakilis and Martin Plaut. The United Nations Security Council is today, due to discuss the ongoing travails of its newest member, South Sudan, which gained independence in 2011, and many of whose people will have spent these 6 years since wondering why they bothered. South Sudan is, by most statistical analyses, one of the world's worst performing nations, plagued by corruption, chaos, and a sputtering civil war. It has even managed to pick a fight with the UN itself, grounding several UN aircraft this week in a row over control of the airport in Juba. Martin, what are the UNSC, and I should make clear that South Sudan is not a member of the Security Council, but the UN itself, what are they going to be told about South Sudan today? It's not going to be good news, is it?
No, well, this is a briefing from the people who are trying to clear up the mess. And they are trying hard, and they are good people. You've got El Hassan Wan, who's very long-standing envoy. You've got Nicholas Haysom, who, when I remember him, used to be called Fink Haysom when we played touch rugby. He's a South African. And you've got Festus Mogae, who is a Botswanan ex-president. All of them are very sensible people, and they are trying everything they can to stop what is certainly not a spluttering war. It's a full-scale war. There's absolute hell going on in there. There are so many little groups as well, which fracture all along the various tribal lines, basically the Dinka-Nuer divide, but then within that many, many other ones. And, you know, the hell that they have inflicted upon their own people is beyond belief. I mean, up to and including burning people in their own houses, mass rape, keeping people in conditions of utter starvation. It's absolutely dreadful, and there's nothing good to say about it, and there is no way out.
There's nothing that can be plausibly done. There is a UN force in South Sudan, UNMISS, approximately 17,000 strong, biggest contingents Bangladesh, Ethiopia, Burkina Faso. Does it need to be bigger?
Oh, it'd have to be, 100, 200, 300,000. The area is enormous. It's a vast swamp. Anybody can hide almost anywhere. There's no chance of getting on top of it with those numbers. What you can do, and what they do, is they encamp around particular points, and then people cluster around them, and they give, shall we say, 500 meters, maybe a kilometer of security, and people live in those in the hopes that they can survive what's going on. But most people are fleeing the country. I mean, you have, maybe a million in the surrounding countries, and then another 1.3 million in Uganda,
which is coming up for a fifth of South Sudan's population having left.
Yeah, it's absolutely tragic, I'm afraid.
Jacob, is this one of the situations in which, in normal circumstances, the bully pulpit of the US presidency might make any kind of difference?
I think, U.S. action in Africa and elsewhere in the world as part of the UN has a mixed history, let's say. But we're running an experiment right now on what happens not only when the U.S. doesn't intervene, but when no one expects the U.S. to intervene. I think it was fair to assume during any of the last three or four or five presidential administrations that in the event of a civil war, some kind of man-made catastrophe, some kind of humanitarian catastrophe, the U.S. would at least be involved at some level, that there was at least the possibility that it might take
more
action.
It was something that protagonists had to factor into their calculations.
It was something that protagonists had to factor into their calculations. I don't think anyone expects the Trump administration to do anything about this. I don't think that anyone expects the Trump administration to take a more active role in the UN. I mean, this is one of those areas where Trumpism and sort of traditional Republican foreign policy, or not traditional Republican foreign policy, but the sort of the current iteration of mainstream Republican thinking, which is that the UN is largely useless and the U.S. should do as little as possible with it. So you have this sense that the U.S. just isn't going to take action, and that I think will play into people's calculations, even if you had even relative to a president who wouldn't have taken action but might have considered it.
With the best will in the world, Martin, and with sort of resources of all kinds available, is anything fixable about South Sudan?
Apart from trying to dismember it still further, but I mean that isn't possible because it is such a spotty relationship between the various ethnic groups. They'll have to live with each other. I think in the end this will burn itself out, but it's going to take a long, long time. I mean and the problem is the UN can be pushed around by almost anyone. I mean the Rwandan troops who were at Juba Airport were just told that they had to get out, and they got out. And when there was, I think it was last year, there was a terrible outbreak of fighting, people going house to house and literally asking people to say a couple of words and shooting anybody who was from the wrong tribe because they had the wrong accent. There was an appeal for the UN to go out, and they didn't at the time. So the UN doesn't have a great reputation. They will occasionally do something, and they certainly bring vast amounts of food aid to stop people starving in vast numbers. So that is enormously helpful. But beyond that, the only other good thing one could say about South Sudan is that the people expect absolutely nothing from their government, and they get it.
Okay, well, finally tonight, these are obviously difficult days to be a statue of a Confederate general anywhere in the United States. However, a statue is a statue and oblivious to the row attending its removal. Spare a thought, then, for any actual human being called Robert Lee, especially if their job involves a public profile. Sports broadcaster ESPN has decided, all things considered, to withdraw their commentator, Robert Lee, from next Saturday's football match between the University of Virginia's Cavaliers and William and Mary College's Tribe in Charlottesville. Jacob, ESPN, I suggest they're just sparing their employee a certain measure of mockery, but haven't they just drawn way more attention to it than would have been if they just let him go ahead and call the game?
I think they were assuming that they would be able to do this and no one would notice. But it leaked somehow and it's become a massive... There was an email that they sent, which actually in a lot of ways was quite reasonable. They say they consulted with him. They suggested that it might be better for his reputation. It might be better for their... fundamentally, it's a self... interested thing. They wanted to avoid being turned into a meme on the internet.
But he could have just opened the broadcast by saying, "I'm Robert Lee, no relation."
Yes, he could have. But this is not necessarily the way that those decision making processes happen at a large corporation. I think they made the sort of the Streisand effect mistake of thinking they could push the issue off stage, no one would notice, and they would avoid embarrassment.
What do you do, Martin, if you are one of the not inconsequential number of Americans, and as Jacob was pointing out off-air earlier, the Attorney General is among them, who is actually named after a Confederate leader?
Well, I suppose you just have to live with it. I mean, it shows the idiocy of, trying to take down statues of historical figures. I mean, apart from Adolf Hitler, I find it difficult to think of anybody who I would really wish to tear down. I think you should just leave these things behind. And, it is all to do with symbolic manipulation. Once you get into symbolic manipulation, then all of a sudden the symbols become important. But, one should never forget the great examples of the Catholic Church, which had some problem with Cardinal Sin in the Philippines. And even worse, sadly, it was always a matter of great mirth. And he used to say, "Please laugh now," to the poor journalists who were in front of him, English-speaking journalists, the Korean Cardinal Bamsak.
We should, of course, also recall the former Zimbabwean president, Kanan Banana.
Indeed, we should.
Who provided generations of African headline writers with no end of mirth, especially that time he jumped bail, prompting the obvious headline, Banana Splits. And that does bring us to the end of today's show. Jacob Parakilis and Martin Plaut, thank you both very much for joining us. Today's edition of Midori House was produced by Marco Sippi, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Isabel Rosen. Our studio manager was David Stevens. More music next at 1900. It's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. I'm back with more on the day's big stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns tomorrow at the same time, 1800 London. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.